It's another week. This is Andrew Wood, Executive Director of Hope Resource Center. Thank you so much for listening. You're either listening live here on Joy 620, or maybe you're tuning into the podcast that'll be up in the next day or so, and you can find that at investinghope.com and, of course, on social media platforms as well. So thank you for tuning in. Today is a day where we're bringing in a guest. From time to time, we will bring in guests from all over the country to talk about pro-life issues and a pro-life ethic. And today, what we're going to focus on is a consistent pro-life ethic and why that is important for Christians to look at our life, I guess our life stance, and we talked about it a number of times on the show, that our pro-life view should be more than a stance. And so today I'm bringing in Caitlin Beatty, who is the editor-at-large for Christianity Today magazine. She's also the author of A Woman's Place, and she recently wrote an article or a blog or a piece on Vox.com, and I would encourage you to read it. The title of the piece is called "I'm a Pro-Life Evangelical. Republicans are pushing a healthcare bill that isn't." And so today the goal is not to get overly political. We won't do that. But what we are going to talk about is why it is important for evangelicals to look at the life issue from a biblical worldview kind of point of view instead of strictly a partisan politic point of view. So, Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So let's just get right into it. So you wrote this piece, and that's where I found it. Actually, a staff member texted it to me one night and said, "I think you would be interested in reading this." And I'm, you know, political science major in college and very into politics. And this last election was a doozy to say the least. And so as we looked at that, reading this article, and headlines grabbed me, and so I read the article and I thought, well, this will be. This deserves my attention and time to look at. And so I immediately read it and then immediately emailed and said, "Hey, can we have a conversation about it?" So, so as we look at one thing you said that really stood out to me in kind of the very beginning of the piece, it says that I believe Christian faith is strongest when it transcends the talking points of Republicans and Democrats alike. And so let's expand on that for a second. As we look at Christians, obviously, we're going to be engaged in the world, and from a political standpoint, certainly, you know, we encourage people to vote. But what do you mean by that statement? Christian faith is its strongest when it transcends the talking points of Republican and Democrats alike.
Yeah, well, what I mean by that is simply that the tenets of our faith transcend any one political party or belief system, and that's always been true throughout the history of the church. There's no one political leader or political party that can claim to be the quote-unquote Christian party. And so in our particular country, we have two major parties, and we might say, you know, on certain issues that Christians care about, this party really gets it right. On other issues that we care about, this party gets it right. But just to remind ourselves that we are Christians first and foremost before we are Republicans or Democrats or independents, that our faith is really our primary identity. And so when we vote every 4 years or when we engage in political debates on social media, we are always to approach those as Christians first and as, you know, our party belief system second. It's important to keep that order in mind when we engage political issues.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. When I was younger, I was 22 years old in a small town in Middle Tennessee, and my great uncle was heavily involved in the local Republican Party, and I was at one of the meetings because I was that guy, being 22 and so much younger than everyone else at those party meetings. And my uncle nominated me for the chairman of the local county party. And I remember I would go around and speak, and I would say, "Look, I'm a Christian first, conservative second, Republican third." And it sounds so good on the campaign trail. I know the vice president says that and different things. But if I was honest with myself, you know, looking back now that I'm older and looking back, if I was honest, the first and second, and even the third, they kind of blurred in with each other. So I care deeply about mm-hmm. the gospel, certainly, but I also care deeply about the way people voted, and I care deeply about the party that I was affiliated with. And one thing that this past election did for me is I tried to kind of pull back for a second and look across the board, and I began to see some inconsistencies in media and kind of the pundits that I came to respect over the years, and going, wait, well, you had a different viewpoint, you know, a few months ago, and now this viewpoint is completely contrast to what we say that we stand for. And so as those lines blur, and as we look and see that some worry more about their political credibility than their faith credibility, as our politics and faith converge, how do we go about correcting this and establishing consistency?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think it's hard, and I appreciate you sharing from your own experience. I think it's hard to maintain that Christian first identity because politics really does speak to our desire to pursue justice and righteousness on a public scale, you know, that we don't just care about what happens in our homes or churches, but we want to see flourishing across the board in society, and each party kind of proclaims or offers a certain vision of the good life. And so I think it's easy to get too emotionally attached to our political views. I think that, you know, one way we can check to make sure that our political views are already always oriented toward the gospel, and that the gospel is informing our political views and not the other way around, is really being rooted in a local church that does the same. Right now in this country, it's currently against tax law for pastors to endorse or really criticize sure. presidential candidates from the pulpit. That's the Johnson Amendment. And actually, a majority of evangelical pastors think this is a good idea. I know that it's been debated more recently, but a majority of evangelical pastors and church members actually think that that's right. You know, that there needs to be a place in our lives where politics doesn't reign. You know, where politics are made to be secondary. And I think when we bring politics too much or too explicitly into the life of the local church, we start getting confused. Okay, what are we rallying around? Mm-hmm. I think if we're all doing our faith right, ideally we're interacting with other believers who think differently than us, who voted differently than us. Maybe we're sitting next to them in the church pew, and maybe that's uncomfortable sometimes, but just to realize that we are Christians first and we're political second, and that what we have in common with each other far transcends what can divide us in our earthly life. You know, we're all headed toward being united in heaven, worshiping Jesus for eternity. So we need to get used to worshiping alongside people who are really different from us to prepare well for heaven. So I think just like I said, it's really important to have a local church that really emphasizes preaching of the gospel, discipleship and evangelism first, and then politics are kind of kept in their rightful secondary place.
Yeah, and I think as we go through that, I'm a part of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, the Advisory Council for 2017, and I recently sat through hours and hours of lectures with Dr. Russell Moore on just ethics across the board, not just when mm-hmm. it comes to abortion and life, but when it comes to soldiers mm-hmm. and when it comes to, I mean, you name it, it was discussed. And the interesting thing about that is, again, it was the importance of being consistent. And so if we're going to say we care deeply about life in the womb, that means we care deeply about life of mom. That means we care deeply about mm-hmm. the issue of doctor-assisted suicide and all of those things. And so it's interesting to have those conversations with people. And so many are because we're, you know, I was even looking on Twitter today and watching with the discussion, you know, with the panel hearing of with Sessions now and Comey the other day, and all you see is people on both sides of the aisle just running to political corners. And so there's not any place where we can sit down and say, well, let's just have a conversation about what we agree on and then go from there and not be motivated by anger or bitterness or we're really at an interesting place as we, you know, articles that we read at times, we're like, I don't know if it's true, if it's not true, you know, different things we see. And so as we try to get through that, what have you seen as you spoke and written? Are you seeing that tends to trend more toward a certain demographic? Are you seeing millennials looking at it a certain way and Gen Xers looking at it a certain way? And what's that been like in your experience?
Yeah, that's a great question. I definitely agree with you. We are at this really unique moment, both in the United States as Americans and then also as American Christians. I think we see just a lot of divides, a lot of rancor, a lot of partisanship. You know, as you said, now there's no, you know, national news media that's necessarily unbiased or centrist. Every media has their own slant, and we all choose which news articles we want to read that basically support what we already believe. So we're in a time of really intense partisanship in the United States, in the church and beyond. And I think, you know, I can't speak for all millennial Christians, but I do think there is this growing sense that some of our forebears in the faith over-aligned with political leaders and maybe gave up some essential aspects of Christian teaching in order to gain political influence. And there are good reasons that those alliances happened in the past, but I do think, you know, millennial Christians want to see a Christian engagement with social issues of the day that transcends both parties. You know, we're not blue, we're not red, we're purple.
Sure.
And that when we retain that distance, I think, from either political party, then we're able to speak more prophetically. So, you know, on the issue of abortion, the Republican Party has been much more consistently pro-life in its policies around abortion. But when you look at an issue like creation care, which is not necessarily a life issue,
Caitlin, I'm sorry to interrupt. We got to go to a quick break, and then let's hold that thought, because that's exactly what I wanted to get into when we come back in the next segment. Is focusing more on life and abortion and what that means for Christians. We'll be back with Caitlin Beatty here in a sec. We're back. It's Andrew Wood, Executive Director of Hope Resource Center. Learn more about Hope at investinghope.com. Today we are joined by Caitlin Beatty, Editor-at-Large for Christianity Today magazine. Thank you again, Caitlin, for joining us. So right before we ended the last segment, we were talking about the abortion issue and how we tend to, at least when it comes to pro-lifers, we tend to connect pro-life to one party, and then on some other things we connect it to another party. But as we as we look at that, what we have found, at least at Hope and in our experience, is many on the left and on the right see pro-life as simply being anti-abortion, and so those of us that disagree with people like me that do the work we do at Hope Resource Center and that would claim to be pro-life, though the people that disagree with me would simply say that I'm anti-abortion and anti-women's rights. And then those that line up with me and pro-lifers would simply say that those that disagree with us are just pro-abortion. And and that obviously is certainly part of it, but our pro-life stance should be much more than simply anti-abortion. And let's expand on that. And you did a little bit with that with your Vox piece in talking about that.
Yeah. So what I was trying to get at in the article is that being pro-life, being for the protection and the care of unborn life, really has to start with protection of and care for women, because in God's amazing design, the livelihood and the flourishing of the unborn child is so intimately connected to the life and the flourishing of the woman who is carrying the child, right? Mm-hmm. So really, I think both extremes of the abortion debate tend to separate those two. There, you know, there are two people involved in the pro-life issue. Well, there are three if you count the person that the woman is in a relationship with, the father of the child. But at the very least, you know, I think both extremes of the abortion debate focus on either the unborn child or the woman. And part of my point is to say, to be pro-life is to be for both the woman and the child. And I think it's possible. You know, I think it is really possible to come up with both, you know, political solutions and then creative community-based solutions that really care for the woman as she is carrying the child to term, with holistic support and care, and also to care for her and her child after the child is born. I think, and, you know, the pro-life movement has done a really wonderful job of speaking out on behalf of the unborn child, because that person does not have a voice. So they really depend on us to use our voices to speak out for them. But that unborn child, if they come into the world, they have a whole life ahead of them. And oftentimes they are being born into difficult circumstances, either economically or relationally. Oftentimes they are born to single moms, and so it's our responsibility as communities of faith and just communities in general to really meet them where they are and ensure that woman has the best chance available of flourishing alongside her child once the child is born.
Yeah, and I appreciate that point, and I think that's why I'm so passionate about the pregnancy center work. There's 2,500 plus pregnancy centers in this country, and all of us are doing, I mean, we do different levels of work. At Hope, we are fully medical, ultrasounds, STD testing and treatment, pregnancy tests, parenting classes, mentoring. We're about to start doing well women visits as well. But on top of that, we also do 50 to 60 baby showers every year for first-time moms, where they receive brand new car seats, pack and plays, everything they're going to need for the first 6 months. And then we always tell them, look, we are not kicking you to the curb. We are here if you need anything. We're constantly following up with these moms. And the point, the reason we, there's a number of reasons why we do that. But the main reason is because we want that patient to know that they are loved, valued, and respected, not just their baby, not just whatever they can produce, but many of our patients have been given seconds and thirds their entire life. And so we want to give them what they deserve, which is the first. And and what we know is 9 times out of 10, we reach mom, baby's going to be okay. And 85% to see an ultrasound, choose life. And what we also know is they already have a ton of obstacles in their way. And so we provide all of our services at no cost to the patient, no cost to the taxpayer, no cost to the government. You know, we just $600,000 worth of services every year because of individuals and churches and businesses that stand with us. And so I appreciate the point. And I think it always, when we talk about this issue, the folks that are not fans of the local church and think the church should do more, and certainly the church could always do more. But the folks that are doing the most fostering are the people in the church. The folks that are doing the most adopting are the people in the church. I do think it's important that we always say that, but certainly challenge our people and challenge, I think, pastors, at least here in Knoxville, the conversations that I have and the opportunities that I have to speak at churches in front of congregations. The pastors have a heart for seeing their people leaving those buildings and actually making an impact in the community. And so, you know, I think at times we tend to say things like social justice warriors as a negative connotation. But as believers, we better care deeply about social justice issues, right? Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. so as we look at that, and as we kind of pull back a little bit, you know, the big mantra at Hope is people are greater than issues. So we care deeply mm-hmm. about issues, but we care more about people. And so mm-hmm. as we do that, and as we start seeing and understanding that every person we come in contact with was created in the image of God, and we try to use that for our narrative, which is a good thing to use for our narrative. But what tends to happen is we muddy it, and we start using image bearers as pawns in our game, and how we can mm-hmm. win that argument. And so, what has been your experience in your conversations and talking with folks? How can we combat the temptation to simply use people that are directly affected by these issues as pawns, and instead of saying, look, this is just someone that's in deep need of love and care. Right. They're not a pawn that can help us win an argument.
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. I think the approach that Hope takes in putting people ahead of issues and talking points is really key, because I think with the issue of abortion, it's very easy to use narratives or anecdotes or stories to make a political point or to win an argument, instead of really attending to the sacred nature of every person and his or her life. I think it's, this is a really good opportunity for Christians so that being pro-life isn't just about how you vote every 4 years right. or every 2 years. It's not just about where you stand on specific legislation, but it's also about how you are in community with women and children. And so it could be everything from volunteering at a pregnancy resource center, to doing the work of adoption and foster care for women who feel like they simply can't raise a child. There's a way to bring the child into the world, and that child has a chance at a good and healthy life.
Absolutely.
It could be, how do you respond to a woman who is not married and is pregnant? There's been, unfortunately, some
sure.
negative press about a school's response to one of their students being pregnant. But what if the school was to come around that girl and say, we are here to support you, and you've made a brave choice to keep your child? So a lot of it's really changing the way we talk about women and unintended pregnancy, even, to make it easier for that woman to carry her child to term.
Absolutely. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Caitlin Beatty. We fall down, we lay our crowns at the feet of Jesus. And we're back. It's Andrew Wood with Hope Resource Center. Thanks again for listening. Today we're joined by Caitlin Beatty, editor-at-large for Christianity Today magazine. Caitlin, as we kind of shift and look toward, okay, what does this mean for Christians and pro-lifers? And one thing that one quote in your piece at Vox.com, which was interesting to me, because I've had these conversations with folks, and when you say this, because of the organization that you talk about within this quote, some people are like, no, that is the silver bullet. But your quote is, I don't believe defunding Planned Parenthood is the silver bullet for the abortion dilemma. And so one would ask, why is that? Of course, I know you answer that within your piece, but let's mm-hmm. talk about that here. Why is that not the silver bullet for the abortion dilemma?
Yeah. So, I mean, I support the efforts to retain the Hyde Amendment, which prevents taxpayer funding from
right.
going to Planned Parenthood. I think that is a really important protection for the many Americans. About half of Americans believe that abortion is morally wrong. So I believe that that's a really important provision that our legislative forces have come up with. The reality is that even if Planned Parenthood were to be totally defunded and were to even be shuttered, the reality is that there would still be women who feel for many complicated reasons that abortion is maybe their best or their only choice. So defunding Planned Parenthood would do a lot to address the supply side of the abortion problem, simply because there would be fewer clinics for women to go to. Defunding Planned Parenthood wouldn't necessarily address the demand side, the fact that there are so many women who feel that abortion is maybe their best option or their only option, or feel pressured to have an abortion. So even if Planned Parenthood were to go away, the demand for abortion would still be there. And so that's where strong social support for women facing unintended pregnancy, for women who, you know, could be economically capsized by bringing a child into the world. That's where those strong social support networks come in, and where places like Hope come in and say, you know, we're going to walk with you through your pregnancy. I know this is scary. You didn't think this is going to happen, and this is a different plan than what you had for your life, but you're not going to be alone. You know, I think that's really important. So many women who do choose abortion make that choice in a sense of desperation or loneliness. And so it's really incumbent, I think, on us as faith communities to rally around those women and to say, you're not alone, and you don't have to walk through this alone, even though it might be hard and scary.
And I think that goes to the blurring of political lines that we talked about earlier, of faith and politics. And so, obviously, I'm not a fan of what Planned Parenthood does, and they're the largest abortion provider
right.
in the country. In Knoxville, they're not providing the bulk of the abortions. That is happening in other places in Knoxville at other abortion clinics, and so. And that's a hard conversation, because they have become the face, and that's some of that's mm-hmm. due to marketing, some of that's due to people on the pro-life side making them the face, but it's also due to they want to be the face of the abortion
right.
issue, and
right.
so as we look at that, yes, we in my opinion I do want them to close their doors, but again, it doesn't change the fact that since 1973, so. For my entire life and then some, abortion has been legal in this country. And so for the bulk of the patients that are finding themselves with an unplanned pregnancy, they've been raised in a country that says it's okay. And so mm-hmm. that's the uphill battle that we have as people that stand for life, is we are arguing that it's wrong, but it's not illegal. And so mm-hmm. that creates a difficult conversation to have. And what I tell every church that I go speak at, what I tell the congregation is, whether we agree or like it or not, the patient, the bulk of our patients at that particular time believe abortion's the only option. And so, mm-hmm. and so if they believe that to be true, I may disagree with them. Obviously, you know, we would say, well, there's multiple options, but that is what they believe. So let's meet them right there, and let's mm-hmm. say, okay, let's have a conversation. And that's what we're able to do at Hope Resource Center. And I think for so many at the local church, Christians have just, for some, they've just always been pro-life. So they haven't really looked in the mirror and said to themselves, why am I pro-life? Why do I mm-hmm. believe the things that I believe? Why am I anti-abortion? Why am I against these things? And so when they're faced with, well, what about rape, incest, life of the mother? When they're faced with these kind of triggering debate topics, they don't know how to respond. Mm-hmm. And so what we find is, we find people on our side that respond with anger. We find people on the other side that respond with anger. And then you can't
yeah.
have a conversation, because both
right.
are so polarized to run to their political corners. And what have you
yeah.
seen with conversations mm-hmm. and your work at Christianity Today? What have you seen with, are we seeing a shift? And I'll tell you my opinion in a second. Are we seeing a shift mm-hmm. with the millennials and the younger generation to say, mm-hmm. look, let's have a conversation about it?
Yeah. I mean, I think, I think right now there are a lot of Christians, and, you know, maybe it's particularly younger Christians, but definitely a lot of Christians who are tired of the political talking points and the political arguments. And I think we realize that people's hearts, at the end of the day, you're probably not going to argue someone into the truth, but you, by being in relationship and establishing a relationship of trust and care, you are able to, you know, just come alongside someone who is in a vulnerable position and say, I'm here for you. So I think it's really wise that resource centers like Hope, you know, you're not starting from a place of arguing with a woman why abortion is wrong. You're starting from a place of, we love you, we're here for you, we're going to care for you through this process. And that relationship is so much more powerful, you know, than the moral argument alone, right?
Right.
Maybe that's a conversation you have later. But I think, you know, it, even on the pro-choice side, there's rhetoric that, you know, Planned Parenthood and other pro-choice leaders use that say, you know, we are here for women. We want to support women. We care for women. And I believe that for a lot of those people, their intentions are good, but they have not considered the moral weight of the fact that you're not just talking about the woman's livelihood, you're talking about another unborn person and their livelihood. So we have to come up with solutions that I think honor both the woman and the child. And I would love to see, you know, it's so hard to say what will happen on the legal front in the next 50 years, but I would love to see in the next 50 years people of goodwill on both sides of this issue come together and say, what are the things that we can agree on? And is there a way to reduce the number of abortions, reduce the need for abortion, and support the life of a woman and a child at the same time? I think that that's possible, but it's going to take moving beyond the polarized rhetoric.
Yeah, and I think that's what I've seen. And I'm saying that from someone that was entrenched in the polarized rhetoric for a long time. And so now that I'm at Hope and the Lord has done a lot of convicting in my life and kind of reshaped some things, it's amazing what happens when you start to see individuals as created in God's image. And instead of how can I use this to push our political view or our narrative? And certainly we have narratives, and certainly we have stories that we share, but using people and people that are struggling that have been used their entire life, then using them for a political gain is concerning. And we're going to go to another break and come back. And what I want to do when we come back is talk about what that looks like holistically. In your piece, you talked about kind of holistic healthcare. And that's what we believe in at Hope Resource Center as well. And we'll talk about that when we come back. And we're back. It's Andrew Wood, Executive Director of Hope Resource Center, today joined by Caitlin Beatty. And Caitlin, we're just really appreciative of you taking the hour out of your day to talk with us about life issues and looking at how we can better as Christians kind of walk through that in our communities as well. And so what I want to end with today is to look at what this means. So legislatively, it certainly means one thing, but as Christians and as we're walking through this process, in your piece at Vox, you said, at the very least, and you're talking about the Affordable Care Act or the new version of, drafters, for them, it would mean keeping pregnancy, maternity, and newborn care coverage mandatory, retaining Medicaid expansion, and diverting the money that would have gone to Planned Parenthood to federally qualified community health centers. Beyond the scope of health care, it could also mean federally backed parental leave, a child alliance, and a more robust financial assistance. So as we look through that, one question that may come from that is, well, what about my conservative small government belief system? What does that do for that? Mm-hmm. And so I'd love for you to walk through that and kind of give your answer on why this is important.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very sympathetic to the argument from small government that we, you know, as communities connected to one another in community, we shouldn't look to the federal government de facto to take care of all of our problems, you know, and I think there are really good reasons to avoid that trend, you know, and if an issue or problem can be addressed in local community or even in something like state government rather than federal government, that we should try that path first. So I'm very sympathetic to those arguments. I do think that when it comes to abortion on a national level, there are certain solutions or aids that the federal government is uniquely capable of covering. So something like Medicaid, which is really there for chronically poor members of society who can't find work or who are born into poverty. This is a social safety net that, as Americans, we have established to provide some kind of safety net of health care for poor members of society. The reality is that many, and I'd have to look into the numbers, but I know that, you know, economic stress is something that leads a lot of women to choose to have abortions because they feel like they simply cannot afford to bring a child into the world. Pregnancy is very expensive. Childbirth, the process of childbirth is expensive. And then, of course, raising a child is very expensive. Are there things that the federal government can uniquely provide to offer women who are economically disadvantaged some kind of social safety net? Now, if she happens to have a strong social support system in her family, in her friends, in her church, there's no reason that we shouldn't also totally support that woman through those local relational means.
Right.
It's not an either or. I think it's a both and. But I think about a friend of mine whose son was born with a genetic defect, and really his family, he's not economically disadvantaged or poor. He has a PhD from a top university, and yet his family has really relied on Medicaid to provide for his son, given the enormous health costs that his son faces. And so, you know, that to me is where we say we should at least support keeping the Medicare coverage that is already provided and certainly not cut it back. Because it, you know, it has a real direct effect on people's lives and on the lives of children. And I think we want to say it's not just about protecting the life up until the moment of birth, but it's about ensuring that the life of the child can flourish long after birth. And that's where I think there are certain federal programs that are important as social safety nets for those cases.
And I think the best way to kind of cap off this conversation is, and we don't even have to expand, I think your words do plenty justice, the last paragraph of the article. Says, I'm waiting for politicians on both sides of the aisle to find political solutions that appeal to a wide swath of Americans. Until then, I'm tempted to check out of politics over disillusionment that Democrats or Republicans care about protecting vulnerable members of society. When partisanship reigns, real political solutions die. And when politics is reduced to winning, then many Americans lose and are left to find the common ground previously abandoned by our country's leaders. I think that sums it up. For me, as someone that watches all of this very closely, certainly from the pro-life standpoint, we are at a place where my ultimate goal is that abortion would be unthinkable in a civilized society. I mean, the company mm-hmm. that we are keeping as a country in terms of our abortion laws is shameful. So when we look at that, my goal isn't that it would simply be illegal. That's not We tried that, and conservatives, quote-unquote, judges gave us Roe v. Wade back in 73 anyway. And so as we as we walk through this and look at it, I think it's important that we are just honest with ourselves and that we're consistent in our rhetoric and that we're consistent in our love and care for, especially from those with a biblical worldview, those neighbors that we come in contact with that were made in the image of God, that have value, that deserve our love, that deserve our respect. And so, Caitlin, I appreciate the conversation today. Where can people learn more about you and find Christianity Today and all of those things?
Yeah, so Christianity Today is at christianitytoday.com, and we publish 10 print issues a year and have new content going up every day on our website. And then more of my writing can be found at caitlinbeatty.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out. Hope to talk to you again soon, and keep up the good work, and we'll be praying for you, and we trust that the Lord will guide us where He wants us to go.
Thank you so much for your time, Andrew.
And that's Caitlin Beatty, the editor-at-large of Christianity Today magazine. This is Andrew Wood, Executive Director of Hope Resource Center. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. We'll talk to you next week.
Lift your head, weary sinner. The river's just ahead. Down the path of forgiveness, salvation's waiting.